Yes. This is episode number 14 of the Midlife Crisis podcast. I know we focus on baseball with opening day coming up in a couple weeks away. Going to change the baseball. I found an author online, Brett Topel, wrote a couple books. One book was about the Philadelphia Athletics, 1927, Murderers Row Yankees were considered one of the best baseball teams ever compiled. The Philadelphia Athletics had a lot of good talent. Not too many people know about it unless you're like a baseball royalty. You had Al Simmons, Mickey Cochran, Lefty Grove, Jimmy Fox, Jimmy Dykes. Also, they were managed by Cornelius McGillicuddy, also known as Connie Mack. What happened to that franchise? It goes in the book. And also, Brett, my next guest, wrote a couple books about the Mets, current, past, and some interesting reads. Very, very unique. First interview I ever had in a train station. But I'm proud to introduce to you Brett Topel from Brooklyn Friends Academy and also Mets author. I think I found you online. I was looking about the 27 Philadelphia Athletics, and I know you wrote a book. I actually bought it. So simply the best. So yeah. I'm in the middle of reading it. So I just wanted to, because I know it sounds like you're a Yankee fan.
Mets fan.
I'm a Mets fan. I'm a Yankee fan. So when the 1998, you good?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right. When the 1998 Yankee team was on, they were talking about one of the best teams ever assembled. So I guess I started doing research at that time, talking about the 1927 Philadelphia Athletics. So I was just started doing the show back in November. I was looking at some different shows, something that would kind of interest me, and Philadelphia Athletics always interests me. So some say that's the best team you never heard of. So overshadowed by the 27 Yankees, you had Murderers Row. But you talk a little bit about Connie Mack and just about the Philadelphia Athletics, and then we can move on to the book. And I know you kind of looked at the 29 team and the 30 team and the 31 team, and the name of the book was simply the best story of the 29, 30, 31 Philadelphia Athletics.
Yeah, well, this is that was a project that I had been working on for a while. And, the 27 Yankees, I guess that was Murderers Row. That was the team that I was kind of charged with figuring out if the 29 and 30 Athletics were better than them. And I kind of, by the end of doing the research for the book, I came to the point where I felt that was true. So that's why I named it simply the best.
Yeah. So what do you think the difference was from the 27 team and the 2019? I guess timing wasn't the greatest between the both of them. So,
yeah, I mean, the 27 team is beyond reproach, right? You're talking about that's Murderers Row. That's, with Ruth and Gehrig and all those guys. And I think, I think that had stood the test of time, or would have stood the test of time, the greatest team. But then you look at, that 29 and 30 Athletics team which was virtually identical. You have guys like, Jimmy Fox and Mickey Cochran and Lefty Grove and, guys that, some of their, they have Hall of Famers that people have never heard of,
Exactly.
So they were, and then Connie Mack, obviously, was, ahead of his time with some of it. He was behind the times in a lot of ways, but ahead of his time when it came to baseball strategy and that 29 team, the 30 team, and then the 31 team, which lost, were pretty incredible.
So the 29 team, they beat the Cubs, and then the 30 team, who did they end up beating? So,
oh God, I don't have it. I happen to be, you're catching me at,
I know you're working at Brooklyn Friends. So
just I am. I'm actually in the middle of transporting, which is my connection is terrible, and I apologize.
Yeah, that's all right. Well, listen, it works. But what do you do for Brooklyn Friends? Is I know you have a publication, or what do you do for Brooklyn Friends?
Yeah, I'm the director of communications and marketing over at Brooklyn Friends. I've been there for 3 years. I handle all their publications, all the internal and external communications. It allows me to still do what I love best, which is writing about baseball. My new book about the Mets, called New York Mets First, just came out a couple of weeks ago. I've written five books about the Mets and their history, and those all came after Simply the Best, which was my first, and really a true passion project. And I was able to do a lot of fun things, including going to Lefty Grove's hometown and doing an event in their public library where his MVP is the Cy Young trophy stand. So, the Philadelphia book brings back a lot of good memories for me.
Where was Lefty Grove's, where was his home? So, Lefty Grove, where was his home?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Lefty Grove, where was he from? You said he went to...
Yeah, he was from a town in Maryland. He actually ended up owning a bowling alley after, I think I'm right, Maryland. He ended up owning a bowling alley in town after he retired and was just known as another one of the townspeople. And his Cy Young Award, I think it was the Cy Young Award or his MVP, excuse me for not being prepared with that. Instead of being in the Hall of Fame, he felt it was really important that it stay in his town. So it actually stayed in the trophy case of the local high school, which he attended for many, many years. And then they realized that's probably not the safest place for that. And they moved it to the public library where it's under some good security now.
Yeah. Well, you alluded to, like, they won a 29 team and then you had the stock market crash. So how did the stock market crash affect the A's at that time? I mean, you know, it wasn't about like what the players are making now, but I mean, you alluded that into the book. I know it's your first book, but.
Yeah. So, you know, Connie Mack, one of the things about Connie Mack was he was not only the manager for 50 years, he also owned the team, which was really unique, which is probably how you could keep your managerial job for 50 years if you're the owner. And listen, just like everybody else in the country, Philadelphia certainly and the Athletics were affected. It affected their fans. It affected how they treated their fans as far as ticket pricing and that sort of thing. The Shy Park, which is where, you know, they played until it was called Connie Mack Stadium, was right in the middle of, you know, a residential area of Philadelphia, not unlike Ebbets Field was in Brooklyn. Those players who played in Philadelphia, even the superstars were really just, you know, back then baseball players were not these guys who made multi-millions. They were regular guys and all for the most part had secondary jobs in the off season. Yeah. And, you know, even, you know, guys like Jimmy Fox and Mickey Cochran, the depression hit everybody. It baseball didn't skip a beat as far as the games and playing. And I think if anything, it was a nice kind of escape for society.
Yeah. And then I know you probably watched the Nolan Ryan documentary on Netflix, but even he said, like, even his off season, he was pumping gas. So even up until the 60s, he still, he still was working. They weren't making the amount of money they were, you know, that they are now. Like, money was increased exponentially. So.
Well, yeah, the money is crazy. Can you imagine pulling into a Sunoco or an Exxon and saying, telling Nolan Ryan to fill it up unleaded, you know?
Yeah, and make it quick, right? But then the Philadelphia Athletics, like, it's almost like a Steinbrenner situation where, like, Connie Mack wanted the players, but his sons wanted kind of the bottom line. And they end up, between, like, George Steinbrenner wanting to win at all costs, and the Halbrenner is more of a conservative, he wants more. He doesn't want to spend the money on players, but kind of get through the gate. So when I was reading the book, I kind of associated two things. It was winning all costs, and I guess that was kind of almost a downfall. Like when they end up moving to Kansas City, and almost like lost their. It's almost like they're a nomadic team because they went from Kansas City and Oakland. Now they announced in November they're going to Las Vegas. So,
yeah, I mean, I think the franchise really lost its heart and soul when they left Philadelphia. I think that was, you know, the Philadelphia Athletics, and at the time they were the cream of the crop in Philadelphia. They were the main team ahead of the Phillies, who came a little bit after. And, you know, I think by the time they got to Kansas City and, of course, Oakland and now we're Vegas and beyond, they never really, like, you don't watch the Oakland A's now and ever associate that team with Connie Mack or Jimmy Fox or, you know, with any of these great players. And it's almost like it's not, yes, it's the same franchise, but it's like, you know, the Baltimore Orioles. Nobody really thinks of the St. Louis Browns when they're watching the Baltimore Orioles. And I think it's, you know, that's the beautiful part of baseball history in my mind, is that you have these teams that existed and then may have moved, may have folded, may have done this or that, but they existed at a point in time and then they were gone. And I think the Philadelphia Athletics, I just consider them being gone. I don't consider them being, you know, the predecessor of the team that's in Oakland right now or eventually in Vegas.
Yeah, well, and also, I think you alluded to, like, Alex went to Kansas City, the New York Giants, and the Dodgers went out to California, and then the Browns left St. Louis, the Braves left Boston. So it was almost like, you know, a shift to these other friends. And that's also, like, with baseball, you get the history of it. So, but
yeah, I think what also, other than New York, which is obviously where I am now, you know, it was very hard in Chicago and Los Angeles. I mean, it was very hard for a lot of cities to support two teams. So it was either going to be, you know, when the Browns ended up moving to Baltimore back, you know, when they did, there was a time where it was actually a consideration that there was going to be the Cardinals that were going to move out of town and not the Browns. Not that the Browns were ever any good, but the Cardinals were in a lot of financial issues. But it's very hard for a city today and certainly then to be able to, you know, maintain two major league ballparks, maintain two major league baseball teams. And, you know, everybody was going out west, right? That was the thing to do. You know, the Dodgers and Giants, the Dodgers kind of hoodwinked the Giants into doing it. They were going to go to Minnesota and you know, Walter O'Malley convinced Horace Stoneham to go to San Francisco. And that was terrible for the Giants. It worked out really well for the Dodgers. you know, Philadelphia moved out. Like you said, the Braves moved to Milwaukee. And it was just a time where the country was getting larger and people were expanding throughout the country. And I think to the detriment of what baseball really was, right? So if you look, I'm not suggesting we should have eight teams in each league anymore, but there was something really special and really powerful when you had so many, you know, great players on a single team. I mean, you don't get that anymore only because there's so many teams.
Yeah, yeah, true.
And also, baseball is not the number one sport for most people, right? They don't grow up playing baseball often, whereas back in those days, that was all they played.
Yeah. Well, now there's so much competition. I think we're around the same age. So, sure. I mean, like back then, baseball was king. But now, you know, you have football, all these other sports, basketball. So it's a lot more competition. But I was also intrigued about your other book that you wrote, When Shea Was Home. My dad's been a Giants ticket holder since 76. He was there when Joe Pisarcik, you know, fumbled the ball. So, you know, growing up as a kid, we never left the game early because he was at that game. And, like, the thing is, it's not over till it's over. So, you know, what was your inspiration about that book? It's pretty, you know, I guess you hear about these things, but you don't really realize it until it happens. All four New York sports franchises are playing in one building. So,
yeah, I mean, it was the only time, only one year that it ever happened. Where all four teams played in one building. I was fascinated by that story. I was a little too young to remember that season, you know, off the top of my head. But doing the research, you know, and none of the teams were really good, to be honest with you, except for the Yankees were starting to get good. That was the year they got Jimmy Catfish Hunter. And there was a year before they got Reggie. And, well, 2 years before they got Reggie, rather. And they're on the brink of being a really good team. But I always wanted to write a book about Shea Stadium. That was the stadium I grew up going to.
Yeah.
It's a stadium that, although the Mets needed a new stadium, I often miss it because, you know, it was as they used to say, it was a barn, but it was our barn.
Yeah, and, I've heard that reference, though.
And, you know, the 75 was a very, very unique time in that, you know, the Jets and the Giants, and you said Joe Pisarcik, you know, in 74, the Giants, all three teams played there in 74, but the Giants actually played at Yale in 74.
Yale Bowl, right?
Yeah, the Yale Bowl. And it was a debacle, and nobody went to, it was just, you know, the New York football Giants, this proud franchise, you know, wins this championship in the 56, you know, the 56, 58, greatest game ever played, blah, blah, blah. And now they're playing in the 70s with a weird NY helmet in the Yale Bowl. So I did have the opportunity for that book to talk to some really special people, including John Mara, the owner of the Giants, who was Wellington Mara's son. He was in college at that time, but he was at every game. And, you know, they used to hang his father in effigy at Shea Stadium. That's how hard it had gotten for the Maras in the mid-70s. So, obviously, the ends justified the means for the Giants, and they ended up having a really good team in the 80s and obviously more recently with Manning. But The 70s was tough for them. Namath was still there for the Jets, but he was a shell of what he once was. The Mets were only 2 years removed from a world championship, but were really not a good team at all. Seaver had a great year. He won a Cy Young that year, his third Cy Young for the Mets. But other than that, it was a really, really rough time for all the teams. And it was a really rough time for Pete Flynn, the head groundskeeper, who I had the pleasure of interviewing for that book.
How'd you find him? So, I mean,
it's actually the greatest story of the book. And it was actually happened before I decided to write the book. I was at Citi Field with my dad, and we were watching a game. And I always run my – I used to call my dad my focus group, because that's who I would run past all the ideas for these books. And I told him about the idea. He goes, oh, wow, that's great. He goes, he had forgotten that all four teams. I said, you know, but the only thing is I have to talk to this guy, Pete Flynn, who had retired when the Mets left Shea Stadium, but he was still around, and they still mentions him now and then. And I was half just sitting in the seats along the third base line, and I looked to my right into the tunnel, and Pete Flynn, for God's sake, was standing there. And I walked over to him, and I said, Mr. Flynn, my name is Brett Topel. I'm thinking about writing a book about the 1975 season at Shea. And he kind of looked away from me, and in a really, really cool Irish brogue, he said, ah, that season be the death of me. So I knew that book had to be written. And I ended up getting information. I interviewed him the next day for a couple of hours. And of course we lost Pete a few years ago, but one of the things that I really appreciate is that Pete's son, Mike, reached out to me after that book came out to thank me for treating his father so respectfully. And, he ended up marrying, the daughter of another groundskeeper, Pete's father did. So it's a whole story of Shea Stadium.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I guess as a writer, you're probably, you know, cherishing those moments. Like you're probably like, yeah, you know, like the light bulb goes off on your head. Like this is
well,
it.
Yeah, and that day when I turned to him and I saw him standing there, like fireworks. It was like 10,000 light bulbs going off. It was just perfect. And then there was a lot of weird stories. I needed somebody that could speak knowledgeably on the 75 Yankees, and I was having a hard time finding somebody, and I just so happened to go to dinner with another couple, my wife and I, and he said, oh, you're into baseball, right? I said, yeah, I'm working on a book, maybe. I'm not sure. He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, my cousin was really into baseball back in the 70s. His name was Marty Appel, and Marty Appel ended up being the PR director for the 75 Yankees. And I said, are you kidding me? Is this like punked here? And so a lot of strange stories in that book. And I wrote them all. They're all in the preface. The entire preface of that book is the two really strange things. And one was Marty Appel, and one was Pete
Flynn. Yeah. But, yeah. I got to check that book out. That sounds like it's hilarious. But you also wrote another Mets book about the Mount Rushmore. Still the same four people on your Mount Rushmore.
So that book, I took a little bit of a different slant, because whereas the Yankees, you can get a Mount Rushmore really easily, right? It's Ruth and Gehrig and Mantle and DiMaggio, and it's like who are you kicking off to put somebody else on?
But for the
Mets, it's more of a generational thing. So I actually wrote Mount Rushmore of the New York Mets and took it decade by decade and did my top four Mets by decade. So 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2010s. I didn't really get into the 20s because it was too early when I wrote that book. So basically, like, your Mount Rushmore might not be the same as your dad's or your son's. I was just having this conversation yesterday with a friend of who the absolute four for the Mets would be. I mean, personally, I know Seaver and Piazza would be on there. And then you could take your pick, you know, either Gooden or Strawberry or Hernandez or David Wright Jacob DeGrom or... You know, there's Jerry Kuzman. There's a lot of options. So,
yeah, Nolan Ryan. I mean, even though he was only there for a short time, but got traded. But you know, they had a lot of great players. And I guess I didn't realize how good of an influence Keith Hernandez was. You know, after that, I watched the documentary on the Mets. You know, how much of an influence he had on that team, and how like he did like the little nuances really to kind of carry the team to the pennant in '86.
Yeah, so Keith was really, although this bothered Gary Carter immensely, but Keith was really the captain of that team. And he was such Keith Hernandez was such a smart baseball person. You know, his baseball IQ was off the charts. Him and Rusty Staub, who they were two, both great friends. Rusty used to be, and I think Keith learned a lot from Rusty, and he would tell you that. Rusty knew everything about every pitcher. He knew the nuances, like you said, and Keith studied pitchers the same way, and he knew what was going on. He knew, you know, he ended up turning a double play one time in 86. It's amazing, an amazing highlight, but the pitcher bunts the ball, and Hernandez is literally on the ball from first base within 3 seconds because he was charging. He just took for granted the guy was going to bunt the ball and turned a double play to third base to first base. He just was a – he was an old-time player playing in the 80s and 70s and 80s, and really you don't see a lot of players like him anymore. And, you know, he's a broadcaster now for SNY, so we hear him all the time and on the Mets broadcast, and he's become like a lovable – I don't want to say mascot, but he's been like the Phil Rizzuto in some ways of the Mets.
And plus, I mean, he had the Seinfeld thing, you know, Seinfeld episode, so it's almost like that. But I mean, yeah, but he's almost like the glue to for that team. And I guess that's exactly what that team needed, especially with all that young talent. But just turn into this season. I know you said you're a Met fan, but like, you know, what's your opinion on Buck Showalter? Like, listen, being a Yankee fan, you know, Buck Showalter, I thought was did a good job, and then he ended up getting fired, and then they brought in Joe Torre. And I remember talking about, like, Joe Torre, he's like a generic manager. He's like, he's almost like, and then he ends up winning in 96. But, you know, Buck Showalter seemed like he got that team ready. Like, what's your, with Carlos Mendoza being the manager now, do you think that they're ready to take the next level, or just kind of just, I know, like, managers hire get fired, but what's your take on that, the manager change?
Yeah, I personally thought they should have given Showalter a little bit more time. He was manager of the year or the year before. They won 101 games, and last year was a disappointment, no doubt. And you know, I don't think those issues were Buck Showalter's. Quite frankly, they relied on, you know, really old veteran pitchers like Verlander and Max Scherzer who didn't work out for them. And I thought Buck Showalter, you know, was a great fit for them. Listen, you have right now. You have an unknown, right? That you don't know what you're going to get out of Mendoza, and you don't know
very true.
You're going to get. You don't know what you're going to get out of the Mets. He's going into the battle with a team that, for the most part, Mets fans don't think is very good, right? Yeah. I mean, maybe they surprise people. Who knows? I mean, there's a lot of avenues to the playoffs these days. But Steve Cohen, the owner, decided for whatever reason to not spend money this year. He had some opportunities to do so. Seems like he's waiting till next year. I think the prized possession, quite frankly, is the guy that your team just got, Juan Soto. I think the Mets want him, and I think, quite frankly, from what I've heard, I think the Mets might have a good chance to get him because he's going to want crazy money, and I don't know if the Yankees are going to be willing to pay somebody more than Judge, you know, on a per year. So we'll see. I think that the Mets last year went in with very high expectations. Showalter took the blame for it, and as we said, lost his job because of it. I think that was short-sighted. I would have given him another run at it at least, because if they didn't think they would have a great team this year, why not have him one more year just to see what he can do? They have some good young players. Their catcher, Alvarez, I think is going to be a really, really solid player. I don't know what they're doing with Pete Alonso. They seem to be playing around and not making it clear that they want him. And you know, they have very, very little pitching. I mean, that's the problem. Their top pitcher is Senga. He's hurt already, shut down for 3 weeks minimum. And, you know, it's one of those, they have Lindor, they have signed him for 10 years. So he's not going anywhere. Nimmo they signed to a huge contract, overpaid for him last year, but had to, right? Because they didn't have anybody else.
Yeah.
And now it's just a matter of seeing, you know, what guys like Marte and McNeil and Brett Beatty, the young third baseman, what they can do, and to see that, you know, we're going to learn what kind of manager Mendoza is. We have no idea. I don't think he could walk past me right now. I don't think anybody in the train station would know who he is.
Well, I think it's ironic that we're talking about the Mets and you know, you're sitting in a subway station, so, or in a train station. So, but, you know, and also when Steve Cohen brought the team, like, it seemed like, like everybody caught fire. He was a hedge fund guy that, like, you know, the money was going to be flowing, and he did spend the money, but now it just seems like, you said, he's tightening up the reins. So I don't know if it's a different strategy. You wait for the right time. Maybe that if you know, they turn out, they'll go out and get a free agent when the time comes, or.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think he spent money when he first got it, but it in some ways was foolish money, and he just thought he was going to be able to kind of buy, you know, come in and spend. And I mean, the Mets last year had the highest payroll in the history of baseball, and look where that got them. So, and then you have teams like the Rays, who year after year have the lowest salary in baseball, and make it pretty far. So I think he's going to lay low a little bit. He hired this guy, David Stearns, who has a very good reputation, but was in a very small market in Milwaukee. Nobody wants a New York team to be general managed as a small market team. That's not going to fly with anybody.
No.
They certainly have it lowered ticket prices. So I think if they get off to a surprisingly good start, I think they would, you know, look at the trade deadline to bring somebody in. Or they're just going to try to pace themselves and convince everybody that next year is going to be their year. But the problem with that is that baseball season is a long season, and if things go poorly, it's a really long season.
Yeah, yeah. And then we touched a little bit about the stadium. What do you think about the new City Field? What's your take on the new stadium? You like it, or just like, you know, I coming as a baseball fan, it was almost kind of neat to see going in there. But I guess the Met fans is like, well, there's no really Mets history. It's more. More like baseball history. So, I mean, what's your take on the new stadium, City Field?
Yeah, so it's funny. You say new stadium, it opened in 2009, right? So
yeah, yeah, already, yeah, exactly. Well, yeah,
I guess 15 years old. Yeah. And your point is 100% correct. When it first opened, the Wilpons, who owned the team at the time, wanted to turn it into sort of a shrine for the Brooklyn Dodgers, who was their team that Fred Wilpon grew up loving. So the entrance to City Field is very much like the entrance to Ebbets Field was. You know, you walk through not the Tom Seaver Rotunda, but you walk through the Jackie Robinson Rotunda, and that's not taking anything away from Jackie Robinson and what he meant to baseball and to the country. But over the years, they've really improved. There's a giant, beautiful statue of Tom Seaver out front now. Before you walk in, it's 10 foot high, you know, 3,000-pound statue. There's a really nice Mets Hall of Fame and museum in there. I think it took a few years, but it finally feels that. And I think this probably really changed around 2015 when they made it to the World Series against Kansas City. It started to feel more like home. And I think that's the case now. And now it's been, I mean, like I said, 15 years. It's really incredible to think that Shea Stadium has been gone that long, but it has. And I do like City Field. And I'll tell you one thing. The one thing that City Field does right is, man, they got the best food in the whole league. I mean, good food options there.
Yeah, well, I went there the inaugural season. You say 2009, you know, it's just like it's new to us, but like, you know, having the Shake Shack there in center field. But they, like when it first opened, it took like an hour and a half. You missed half the game waiting in line to get a Shake Shack.
You're 100% right. And the other thing is that Shake Shack at the time, you couldn't find Shake Shack anywhere else. Now in New York, Shake Shack's on every corner.
In New York,
so the demand is not there. And you still get long lines there, no doubt. But you know, the first year they had the outfield wall was painted black in reference to the New York Giants. Now it's blue. You know, they've really increased the Mets historical part of that. So I think there's no mistake now. If you walked into City Field now, I think you'd see a very different place than you saw in 2009.
Well, what was your connection to the club? Now I know you said you're a Mets fan. You wrote a couple books. Like, how did you get involved with the Mets? Like, just your love for the team. Like, what was your connection to the team?
It's funny you mentioned that, because I write about this in the acknowledgments of my new book. Is that I always thought I was a Mets fan because my dad was a Mets fan. Because growing up, he was a Mets fan. He was a New York Giants fan, a Willie Mays guy, and. You know, I grew up in the early 70s, early mid 70s. The Mets were terrible, but that's who we rooted for. So that's who I rooted for. And it used to be really easy to, you know, go to Shea Stadium on a Sunday morning, wake up and go to a game and get really good seats. So we always did that. And it was only last year that my dad actually confided in me and said, you know, I'm a Mets fan more because you're a Mets fan than the other way around, because I was so passionate about it growing up. And he, you know, in the late 60s, my dad was in Vietnam and getting married and I was being born. And you know, he kind of put baseball to the side. So it wasn't until the mid 80s when the Mets started getting really good, and I was, you know, a teenager and really started being passionate. And when I say passionate, like remote control throwing passionate.
Yeah.
But I'll still tell people that I'm a Mets fan because my dad's a Mets fan. I have no problem with that.
And what book are you working on now? I know you wrote a couple books. You also co-authored a couple books. What book are you working on now?
Yeah, so the book that just came out, actually, I'm not working on anything at this moment, but the book that just came out a couple of weeks ago is my latest project. It's called New York Mets Firsts. It's a collection of, it's like a Q&A format, about 300 pages of, all the different firsts in Mets history. Of course, you have, first batter, first home run, but it obviously goes a lot deeper than that. And I tell the stories behind the stories of a lot of those firsts. So I think it's a fun read, hopefully, for Mets fans and maybe for baseball fans, because it certainly touches on a lot of other teams, because a lot of the Mets firsts happened against, obviously, other people made firsts. The first guy to hit a home running at Citi Field was a Padre, so first guy to get a save was Heath Bell at a Padre. So we go into all that, and New York Mets Firsts is, and all my books actually are available on my website. If I could plug it, topelmetsbook.com.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's where I found you. But, I know I got you in the middle of your workday. So, what would you say your best baseball movies, three best baseball movies you had? Just on you with that. And then also three best baseball movies, three best baseball books that you read.
All right, three best baseball movies. I always start with Field of Dreams. I always love Field of Dreams. Field of Dreams I can watch any day. For more of a fun kind of thing, I always loved Major League. And I'm actually a big fan of The Natural. I know it's a little old-fashioned and a little quirky, but and a little whatever. But I always liked The Natural. I thought that was I thought the baseball wasn't great in it, but the story moved nicely.
Yeah, yeah. And what about books? What books kind of got you inspired to go?
Yeah, so Marty Appel, actually, who I mentioned and I was able to interview for When Shea Was Home, wrote a really great biography of Casey Stengel just a few years ago.
Yes, it's
a great,
yes.
Great, great book. And then there's a great book, which I love, which I'm not going to get the title right, but it's a book that ties religion and spirituality to baseball. It's really, really good. It's not about, you don't have to be a religious person, because I'm not, but it really, it talked about, I think it was called like Baseball as a Religion, something like that. Forgive me for not having the exact title.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I know I'm putting you on the spot, so that's
The other book I really enjoyed was the most recent Willie Mays biography. I thought that was a really, I was kind of born into that book just because my dad was such a Mays fan, and I obviously didn't get him to see him play even when he came to the Mets. It was too early in my life for me to remember. He came back in '72 and was on the '73 team, but. I will tell you about Mays, and it was nice full circle for me, is last year I attended Old Timers Day at Citi Field. It was the first time the Mets had Old Timers Day in many, many years. And one of the things they did was retired Willie Mays' number, even though he was not a Met for more than 2 years and was not a star with the Mets. He was obviously a star in New York National League Baseball. So to have them retire the number 24 and put it up in the rafters with Piazza and Seaver and Hernandez and Casey Stengel and Gil Hodges was pretty special.
Yeah, well, listen, Brett, thanks for the time and thanks for reaching out. And thanks for being accommodated. And good luck with the new book. And I'm delving into this Philadelphia Athletics book, which is really, detail oriented. It's a nice read. So, but thanks, Brett. And then good luck with your position at Brooklyn Friends. And thanks for taking time out of your day to speak to me. I really appreciate it. Thanks for your knowledge of the Mets, especially with opening day coming about, less than 30 days away. It's just, when it's by the time this episode broadcasts, people will start having the appetite for baseball, especially Mets baseball. So, but anyway, but thanks, Brett. I appreciate the time.
I really appreciate the opportunity to be on. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Definitely plug your one more plug about your website. What's the website for your books? What's the website for your book?
It's my last name, topelmetsbook.com.
Okay. All right, Brett. Have a good day. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you. Thanks great. So much.
This is the first time I interviewed somebody at a train station. So
I hope the connection is okay.
Yeah, that's right. It works. Whatever works, right? Whatever works.
Best of luck to you in the show.
Yeah, thank you. Well, thanks, Brett, for your time. Make sure you check out some of his books. Looks like he has a lot of good content there to read. Also, tune in to around tournament time. I'm going to have a couple of special guests come on about the basketball and also the post New Jersey basketball season, and a couple of coaches on. And feel free to follow me on social media. Look out for in a couple of weeks some interesting social media posts I'll have on from past shows. If you miss anything, follow the podcast on Midlife Crisis on your streaming networks. Also, if you feel free to contact me via email, via social media at any time. Look forward to episode 15 in the coming weeks. Thank you for your time and hope you enjoyed the 15 episodes so far.